Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, Mike, a glucose molecule walked into the bar and the barman said, "Hey, what can I get you, sweetie?"
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's Medical Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Todorovic, joined by my co-host, Dr. Matthew Barton.
Mike, how are you?
Good, mate. How are you?
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, well, at least one of us is. Today, we're going through a really extensive, complex.
Is it extensive?
Yeah, I think it is. I put up on Twitter a post of the photograph of the, what we're talking about today sitting in front of me, of my page, and I said, everybody looking forward to this? And I would have had maybe 50 replies of current medicos going, oh, I've intentionally forgotten this.
Worst topic ever.
Hate this.
Hashtag rubbish.
That was just about me. It's glycolysis.
Krebs.
Well, no, it's glycolysis, Krebs, and the electron transport chain, cumulatively known as cellular respiration.
Okay.
So it's a big topic.
So this is how cells breathe.
It is how cells breathe. It's how we create energy. And you and I had a chat about how should we do this. Should we do this as a glycolysis episode and then a Krebs episode and then an electron transport chain episode? And we thought, well, I think what's lost when you do that is the big picture, the whole purpose of these systems. They all work together. And I think talking about cellular respiration in the context of utilizing glucose as the primary fuel source for energy in this episode – and then in a future episode, we can talk about utilizing non-glucose-based fuel sources for energy. So talking about fatty acids, talking about amino acids, talking about lactate, talking about ketones. We can do a whole episode following those pathways. But this one is following the glucose-based pathway.
Okay.
So beginning with glucose, what is glucose?
Glucose is a monosaccharide.
Right.
Okay. So would you say it's the most abundant one?
I don't know about the most abundant one, but it's the most utilized one.
In the body?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a carbohydrate?
Yeah.
In its simplest form, right?
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Yeah. Carbohydrates are complex polymers of sugars, and the simplest sugar, meaning you can't break it down any further, is going to be that of glucose. But there's two main other monosaccharides like glucose, right?
Yeah. So fructose and galactose.
Yeah.
And because they're on their own, they have been separated from other forms of more complex carbohydrate. So sometimes they can be as a disaccharide, which would be a fairly common way that we would ingest sugars, right?
Yeah.
So if you were to put sugar into your coffee or tea, that would be in the form of sucrose. and that would be just two glucose together, right? No, wait. A glucose and a fructose together.
Glucose, fructose. Yeah. Yep.
And if you were to have add milk to it, that would be another sugar. That would be lactose, which would be glucose, galactose.
Yep.
And then the last one, maltose. That's right.
Oh, yeah, maltose.
So maltose is glucose, glucose, which I don't know. What's malt?
I don't know. Like, it's like a – I don't know how you'd describe malt.
Okay. Milo? Is that malt?
I was thinking Milo, maybe.
Anyway, so that's
– Do people have Milo outside of Australia?
Yeah, I think it's big in the UK.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. Anyway, so that's the disaccharides, and you obviously need enzymes in your digestive tract to break those into the simple ones, which again we'll just say as glucose, fructose, galactose.
Yeah.
And the one that, you know, is commonly problematic is lactase to break down lactose, and then as a result people get lactose intolerance symptoms, which would be bloating and diarrhea and stuff like that.
Yeah.
When you look at a more complex carbohydrate, let's just say like wheat or rice or something, that's probably just glucose in long chains, right? And you just have to chop them into the individual either disaccharide or monosaccharides. But essentially what needs to happen is you need to absorb these monosaccharides across your intestinal wall into your blood.
Yeah, so regardless of how you're ingesting your carbohydrates, ultimately you're going to break them down into those monomers of sugar,
yep,
which will be glucose, fructose, galactose. And they get absorbed from the gut into the bloodstream. And as we know, whatever gets absorbed from the gut into the bloodstream will go to the liver first. So the beginning of this conversation of cellular respiration, I think, begins with these monomers of sugar entering our liver cells. And generally speaking, there are transporters of sugars called GLUTs, or glucose transporters. You call them GLUTs, which makes sense because it's glucose transporter. But I like
GLUT. It's not how it's pronounced.
No, they're GLUT. And I like GLUT because it sounds like gluttony, which sort of makes sense because you're talking about ingestion of food and sugars and things like that. So you've got various GLUTs, so glucose transporters. They're basically just channels in cells that when glucose is abundant, they pop to the surface and they allow for glucose to diffuse into the cell.
So the point here is glucose can't get across the cell membrane without these transporters?
Yeah, glucose is a polar molecule. So if you look at glucose and write it down chemically, it's C6H12O6, 6 carbons, 12 hydrogens, 6 oxygens. And because of those oxygens and the way it's configured, it is charged. So that's what we call a polar molecule. And we know that anything that's large or charged, so glucose is both quite large and it's charged. So it can't freely move into a cell unless there's a doorway.
So it's like the putting two magnets together that push each other away.
Yeah, basically right.
So glucose can't get into the cell without these transporters.
Yes. And there's many different type of glucose transporters. They also help.
As in categories.
Yes. And they also help transport fructose and galactose as well. But basically, I want to talk very briefly about some of these glucose transporters because I think they're important. And we should have a chat about exactly where these glucose transporters are and what they do. So first thing is, if you take a look at these glucose transporters, there's a fast way to remember them. And that fast way is by...
is this your fast way?
This is my fast way, which you don't necessarily agree is a fast way. So I've got a mnemonic. And the
I'm not disagreeing with mnemonics, but sometimes mnemonics make it more challenging to remember than...
Well, let the listener decide about this. So this is the mnemonic. Big, fierce bullies kick small little pipsqueaks, producing nervous kids and mad fathers. I'll say it again. Big, fierce bullies kick small little pipsqueaks, producing nervous kids and mad fathers.
See, I wouldn't need a mnemonic to remember the mnemonic.
I don't think it's that bad. Okay, so big, fierce bullies. That is glucose 1 transporter. That's GLUT 1. Kick small little pipsqueaks. That's glucose 2 transporter, GLUT 2. Producing nervous kids. That's glucose 3 transporter. And mad fathers is glucose 4 transporter. Now, the reason why we've got...
Those words that those fit words, into each
tissue type.
Glute. Yeah.
So, big fierce bullies, blood, fetus, blood-brain barrier.
GLUT1?
So GLUT1 is located on those tissues.
So, brain?
Brain, blood-brain barrier.
Yeah.
Fetus and blood.
Okay.
All right.
When you say fetus, is it the fetus or is it the placenta?
Nope, fetus.
Okay.
Yep.
Wow.
It changes.
Amazing.
Yeah. Then you've got kick, small little pipsqueaks. That's kidneys, small intestines, liver, and pancreas. Mm-hmm. They have glucose.
So say that's ready again.
Kidneys,
yeah.
Small intestines, mm-hmm. liver, and pancreas. They have GLUT2 receptors or GLUT2 transporters. Then you've got producing nervous kids. That's placenta, neurons,
oh, it's placenta.
And kidneys again, because kidneys have multitude of types of glucose transporters. That's GLUT3, those three, placenta, neurons, kidneys. Then you've got mad fathers, which is muscle and fat or adipose. And this is going to be GLUT4, glucose 4 transporters. Now, here's the thing. GLUT1, 2, 3, and 4, they are not sitting on the surface of the cell. Something needs to trigger them to get to the surface of the cell. And often it's insulin. So what you'll find is that insulin is required for glucose to enter a cell. That's the dogma that we
yep.
teach. But in actual fact, most tissues don't require insulin. So those first three, glucose 1, glucose 2, glucose 3 transporters, which means blood, fetus, blood-brain barrier, kidneys, small intestines,
when you say
liver,
blood,
pancreas, placenta, neurons, and kidneys, they don't require insulin for the glucose to get into the cell via those glucose 1, 2, and 3 transporters.
And when you say blood, it's blood cells.
Blood cells.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. However, glucose 4 transporters, muscle and adipose tissue, or muscle and fat, they do require insulin. And the insulin triggers the glucose 4 transporter to come to the surface so that the glucose can get in. So they're insulin dependent.
Right, so that's it's tyrosine kinase receptor, right? Which once insulin binds to that, it does intracellular processes, which pushes these receptors or transporters up to the surface. Is that what you said?
Yes.
So they're not normally there. That's what you said.
That's right. And glucose will always move through the channel down its concentration gradient, which means these transporters are bidirectional. So if the glucose increases to a high quantity in the cell, effectively they can diffuse back out again if the channel is on the surface.
But would you say that for GLUT4, which is fat and muscle,
yeah.
that they would play a significant role in how much glucose is sucked out of the blood though? Even though that there are only two tissue types.
Oh, yeah. That I think that's the most important point, is that a question could be raised. I said most tissues don't require insulin, so then someone could argue, then why do we need insulin? Why is it so important for blood glucose management? It's because when you look at all those different tissue types, muscle and fat that requires the insulin for the glucose getting, that makes up a huge percentage of your body mass. And so without insulin, most glucose is trapped in the bloodstream. You need the insulin to get pulled out into the muscle and adipose tissue.
So that's interesting, because I was going to bring this in a bit later just as a fact, but I think I'll put it in here now. If you look at the body, the cells in your body, how many do we have approximately again?
30 trillion.
Okay.
Most of red blood cells are.
Yeah, that's right. So 25 trillion cells. So that's, let's just say, between 60 and 70% of your cells in your body are red blood cells.
Yeah.
All right. Now, they don't need insulin.
Correct.
Right? So percentage-wise, if you just look at muscle and fat cells as a percentage of your whole body cells, they're not very...
No. Volume-wise, though.
Volume. And how hungry they are for glucose.
Exactly. Right. Because red blood cells, they carry oxygen. That's what most of the cell does. And they get transported through the bloodstream. Metabolically, they're not necessarily overactive cell types.
Yeah, I think the ATP that they need to make, which is because they don't have a mitochondria, which we'll talk about later when we're doing Krebs and so forth, they're only really making enough ATP for things like just making sure that their membrane is in the shape that they
want
it.
Exactly right.
And then as they get a bit old, they lose that ability, and that's why they get weird shaped.
Yes.
And then they get killed off in the spleen.
Yes, but you think about muscle.
Needs a lot of, and hence why they have so much mitochondria in it, right?
Exactly right, yeah. All right, so now what we've done is we've set the scene that we're hitting the liver now, because I told you we've ingested all these carbohydrates, broken them down to the glucose, fructose, galactose. It's reached the liver, it needs to get inside the liver, doesn't need insulin to do this, but it does need the GLUT2 or GLUT2
transport. That's sperm.
Excuse me?
Sperm. Is that in your glute list?
It's not a carbohydrate.
No, I mean, does that need insulin to make its energy? Because it's got a crap load of mitochondria.
Fructose. Yeah. Fructose, which it gets from the semen.
Okay.
From the prostate. No, from the...
seminal vesicle.
Seminal vesicle, yeah.
Anyway, keep going.
Okay. Glad you brought that up. So the fructose, the galactose and the glucose get into the liver cell. Now, mainly glucose is going to be using that glucose 2 transporter to get in, and fructose will be using this as well predominantly, and it gets into the hepatocyte, the liver cell. So the question now is what happens? Let's first focus on glucose, and then we can bring those other ones in when relevant.
So are we saying glucose in the cell of every cell in the body now?
No, in the hepatocyte.
Yeah. Okay, can I just ask why are we just focusing on the hepatocyte at this point?
Because the hepatocyte is the primary organ of metabolism when it comes to, if you think about all the various metabolic processes, the liver undergoes basically all of them.
Okay.
So the liver is the major storage site mm-hmm. for unused glucose.
Okay.
Right? So it's not a muscle tissue. But the thing is that the liver is friendly to other tissues of the body. It's generous. So the liver can store glucose if it doesn't use it and can give it to every other tissue of the body. Muscle, while it also stores glucose to a high degree, won't share it with any other tissue.
Okay.
So the liver is really important because all of these micronutrients go to the liver first for processing. And so the first place that glucose will be processed is going to be in the liver.
All right, okay.
So I think it's always good to talk about the hepatocyte. So the hepatocyte, being the liver cell, now has glucose in it. Glucose being glucose 6-phosphate. The question we need to ask ourselves is, why do we need this glucose? Why are we playing around with it? Well, ultimately, what's the point of talking about cellular respiration and glucose? And the analogy I like to use is that basically the body takes glucose as though it's a used car. It's stripping it for parts, for those parts to be used elsewhere in a more useful manner.
Like in a different machine.
In a different machine.
To make something else.
Yes. And so the question then is, what are we stripping from glucose? And the answer to that is we're stripping electrons.
Okay.
And, well, electrons and hydrogen ions. And often they're bound together to form something called hydride ions, which is a negatively charged hydrogen ion, right? So we are stripping glucose, C6H12O6.
So this is a six carbon sugar?
Six carbon sugar, heaps of hydrogen available. So we can strip those hydrogens, strip the negative charged electrons as well, bound them with an intermediate chemical that can hold on to those hydrogens and electrons and take that chemical down to the electron transport chain for us to produce a huge amount of ATP. So that's what
this is like making vacuum cleaners, and the vacuum cleaners are going to be changing gradients of hydrogen to drive a spinning turbine to make ATP.
Let's say yes. All right. So we have the glucose. We know we need to strip it, but to strip it, just like with a car, you can't just suddenly just take the doors off and then you take this off. Sometimes, you know, to get to the deeper parts, you need to pull things off and rearrange it.
All right.
And that's what we've got to do to glucose. We've got to rearrange this molecule.
I don't think you've ever stripped a car before.
And break it off. Yeah, I've taken the carburetor out of the alternator's exhaust and put it on the clutch. So you got to rearrange the molecule in order to strip it properly. That's what we first need to do. So we start with glucose, and glucose needs to be rearranged into something called glucose 6.
Wait. Before we get to this, so at this point now, we're purely focusing on glycolysis.
Correct.
Yeah? Okay.
So this is what we want to do is rearrange glucose, strip it of as many hydrogens and electrons as we possibly can. That's glycolysis. This is one pathway.
Yep. So this is a pathway that happens in all cells, but I know we're focusing on the liver.
Yep.
All cells will do this.
Yep.
And this will happen in the cytoplasm of cells.
And it is...
So it doesn't need mitochondria at this point?
No mitochondria.
And it doesn't need oxygen.
Great point. Yeah. Two perfect points to highlight. It's not happening in the mitochondria like the other two processes we're going to talk about, which is Krebs cycle and electron transport chain. And it doesn't require oxygen, unlike the terminal portion of the...
And before we get into the nitty-gritty, how many kind of steps does this have to go through for glycolysis? Is it like eight or something?
It is... I'm going to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, Yeah, eight. Okay. 8 to 9, depending on other intermediates. So it's an 8-step process. So we're going to talk about each molecule in this 8-step process, the enzymes used, and some of the important cofactors. But we're not going to do it in a way that's just boring and ridiculous. No. We're going to talk about what's really important to understand here.
And can I add just one more final point?
Yeah, of course. Let's just keep making it more difficult for everybody.
I think it's making it a bit easier.
Okay, let's go.
Another thing just to add to glycolysis in terms of an overview is that it has two phases. It has an energy-consuming phase and an energy-producing phase.
That's very important as well.
So it's like the Dr. Mike business. We have to invest in it.
Have we had the ATP-making phase before
we produce, let's say, any money.
Yes.
So we have to, you know...
When will that happen?
Buy certain things first, like microphones and...
cars.
Interfaces and stuff like before we can, potentially make money from podcasts.
Wow.
But we're obviously in the consuming phase and we haven't
got to the past 5 years. Yeah.
All right. This will make sense in a second.
That's a great point. In glycolysis, an investment of energy must be made in the beginning for there to be an energy return.
So what
we'll talk about that.
Because you're going to go through the steps really well because it's cemented in your brain well. Yeah, okay. Not so much for me. But I'll have like the tracker, like the clicker, and I'll tell you when we've lost energy and when we're making back some money here.
All right.
Okay.
First step is glucose must be turned into something called glucose 6-phosphate. So a phosphate is a phosphorus with 4 oxygen with a couple of negative charges. Generally it's PO4-3 negative is phosphate. So this needs to be snapped on to this glucose molecule. Now because glucose is a 6-carbon molecule, C6H12O6, the phosphate needs to be attached to one of these 6 carbons. Now because it's called glucose 6-phosphate, the phosphate is attached to the 6th glucose. So there you go.
Where do you get the phosphate from, Michael?
So great question. We take this phosphate from ATP, adenosine triphosphate. So adenosine is a chemical which is attached to 3 phosphate molecules. And as we are all probably aware, ATP is the energy currency of the body. We use ATP to do everything. And the way we use ATP is that it has 3 phosphates, high energy bonds. This adenosine is bound to phosphates. And if you snap a phosphate off, it releases a bit of energy that we can use to perform work.
Okay.
And so that's what happens here. We snap off a phosphate from ATP, give it to the glucose, snap it onto the 6th carbon, and now we've got glucose 6-phosphate. But what have we just used up?
First investment, 1 loss.
Exactly.
So we're negative. We're in the red by 1.
We are.
Okay.
Now, there was an enzyme that needed to do this.
A kinase.
That's right. And so there's 2 major types of enzymes that do this depending on where you are, glucokinase and hexokinase. We're in the liver, so we're using glucokinase. Hexokinase happens in other tissues of the body. You cool with that?
Yep. And I think the important point there is all the other tissue bar the liver. Is it just the liver that does it?
And does what?
Maybe kidney as well. What are the tissue types that have hexokinase? Is that all body?
All body.
Okay, glucokinase?
Just the liver.
Just the liver. And the important point there, I think, if I remember back to biochemistry, this is now glucokinase is reversible. So it can repackage glucose 6-phosphate back into glucose so the liver can pump out glucose into the blood if you are in a fasting state.
But not in other tissues.
Not in other tissues. So the point here is with hexokinase, you've now locked the glucose molecule into this process and it can't reverse its way out.
Yes, it's an irreversible step. Yeah. So, and generally when you add a phosphate, it tends to be an irreversible step.
Okay.
So this first step, irreversible, and we now produce glucose 6-phosphate through the enzyme glucokinase. Now, we've got glucose 6-phosphate, we need to turn it into something called fructose 6-phosphate. So, fructose. We spoke about fructose as being one of the monomers similar to glucose. In actual fact, if you write glucose down, and I said it's C6H12O6, if you were to write fructose down, Matt, do you know what it would be? C6H12O6. Glucose and fructose are chemically identical in regards to their formula, but
they don't look the same.
They're just rearranged. That's it. It's just the...
So they're the isomers from either.
They are isomers of one another. And so to turn glucose 6-phosphate to fructose 6-phosphate, you don't add or remove anything. You just rearrange. And when you rearrange a molecule, you either use an enzyme called an isomerase or a mutase.
Okay.
And in this case, we're using an isomerase. And so it's called phosphoglucose because it's a phosphorylated glucose molecule. Isomerase. Easy.
Okay.
So we've just rearranged it. That's all you need to know. But the phosphate is still on the 6th carbon. Now we've got fructose 6-phosphate. Are you cool with that?
I'm.
All right. This is a reversible step, so you're aware. Now, from fructose 6-phosphate, we need to go down to fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. So we were fructose 6-phosphate. Now we're going to be fructose 1,6.
You need another phosphate.
Bisphosphate. You've got to add another phosphate. Where do we get that phosphate
this
from?
Is another business investment.
That's right. One more ATP comes in. You snap off a phosphate. It's now ADP, and you've attached this phosphate to the first carbon of the glucose molecule. So now if you have a look, you've got a phosphate on the first carbon, a phosphate on the 6th carbon, and that's why it's called fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. Now, it's not biphosphate. That would mean that the phosphates are next to each other. It's bisphosphate, which tells you there's a space between the two phosphates.
And that's a big space.
Big space.
1 and 6.
That's right. Okay. Now, the enzyme here is called phosphofructokinase.
Okay.
Now, it's a kinase because you're playing around with phosphate. Anytime you hear kinase, phosphate. Remember the first step? Glucokinase.
Yep.
Here, phosphofructokinase. Playing around with phosphate. This is irreversible as well.
Yeah.
And so this step is, 3, can't go back.
And I'll bring in a point here is that this is a rate limiting step for a glycolysis, which means that you can do certain things. There's certain intermediates that will play around with the speed of this enzyme. What was this enzyme called again?
Phosphofructose kinase.
So can I just call it PFK1?
Well, that's the thing. It's phosphofructokinase 1 because okay. There's a phosphofructokinase 2. Yep. Yeah.
So some of the things that will slow this enzyme's activity down would be ATP.
Right.
So if the cell is energized, like got a lot of energy already, which would be seen in the presence of ATP, it will slow this enzyme down because it's basically saying, look, we've already got a lot of energy here, relax, stop, we don't need to make more, just slow down a bit.
Yeah, generally speaking, if you have a high abundance of downstream products, they tend to be negative regulators of what's happening upstream. So ATP is a common negative regulator for upstream metabolic processes.
And the other one is citrate, which is a byproduct of the Krebs cycle.
That's right.
And so if that starts building up, which would just suggest, again, things are in overabundance downstream, feeds back up and says slow down because we're pretty busy downstream.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
The only thing that speeds up this enzyme is fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, which is a kind of a side production line. I don't really want to talk more about anything more there unless you want to add something. But just as a side point, this enzyme PFK1 can be sped up by a close intermediate, which is fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. Sorry, fructose 2,6-bisphosphate.
Yeah, I think its job, and I could be wrong, but I think its job is it actually helps facilitate the kinase process. So it helps to facilitate adding the phosphate group. So if that's in a high abundance, then the phosphofructokinase will work quite efficiently.
Yep. Is it just as a side point to add here, because we did speak about galactose and fructose, which are the other monosaccharides, can we just say this is the kind of region where fructose and galactose will come into glycolysis?
Yeah, so generally speaking...
In the liver, that is.
Yeah, so fructose is coming a little bit later.
Okay.
Basically, fructose is coming in at the next step of glycolysis, but galactose has already come in into
glucose 6-phosphate.
Right. That's right. All right, so now we've got fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. Now, so we've got a phosphate on the first carbon, phosphate on the 6th carbon or the last carbon. So now we have this enzyme called aldose, which basically just snaps it in half. So now you've got 2 3-carbon molecules.
Okay, so we've got a 6-carbon molecule that we've just cut right in half, and now we've got 2 3-carbon molecules.
Yep, and one of them has a phosphate on the first carbon and the other one has a phosphate on the last carbon, which in this case will now be the third carbon. So we've got a phosphate on carbon one and a phosphate on carbon three of the other. So the one that's got the phosphate on the first carbon is called dihydroxyacetone phosphate, right? Dihydroxyacetone phosphate. And the other one is called glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. So glyceraldehyde is the molecule now with three carbons, 3-phosphate because it's got the phosphate on the third carbon. So the aldose enzyme is what performed this splitting process.
Okay.
But ultimately, we want to turn the dihydroxyacetone phosphate, the one with the phosphate on the first carbon, into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. And we do that through an enzyme called triose phosphate isomerase. Again, isomerase because it's just rearranging where that phosphate sits, right?
Okay.
And then what we end up having is two molecules, so two 3-carbon molecules of glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate.
Okay.
You cool with that?
Yep.
Now, here's where we start to make a return on our investment.
Yes.
Right? Now, we were talking about where does fructose come in. Fructose actually jumps in at this step to become dihydroxyacetone phosphate, which then gets transferred into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate through triose phosphate isomerase. That's where fructose comes in. Cool with that?
Yes.
All right. So anyway, we've got glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. It's a 3-carbon molecule with phosphate on the third carbon. We have two sets of them. And using an enzyme called glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase. So when you hear about dehydrogenase, you need to start thinking about a new molecule that's come in now. A cofactor called NAD+.
Okay, so this is going to be part of the machinery because you spoke about the car.
Yep.
This is going to be making the vacuum cleaners and I'll talk about it later.
This is now grabbing a hold of the important components that we need to make energy down the track. So, yeah. So
well, actually, no, I shouldn't say it's making the vacuum cleaners. It's giving the electricity for the vacuum cleaners.
Yeah, it's – I don't know how complex we're going to make the analogy, but I think that it's taking the important parts and carrying it to where they need to go.
Okay.
So now let's think about this. NAD+, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, important. It's actually coming from a certain B vitamin. Do you know which B vitamin it comes from?
Can you keep on the name or the number?
The number.
Three.
Yeah. B3. Vitamin B3 is important to make nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide.
So what is B3 called?
Nicotinamide, isn't it?
Niacin?
Niacin, sorry. Okay. Yes, niacin. So nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, I'm just going to say NAD, is formed from niacin, which is B3. So you need B3 for this process. All right. It's called NAD+. It has a positive charge associated with it. What NAD+ does, and this is where it gets a little bit tricky, but this is probably the most important part of this entire podcast.
Wow.
Yep.
Big call.
No joke. So NAD+, it's going to steal a hydrogen from glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. Now a hydrogen, if you look at the periodic table, is which element? Which number element?
The first.
So what does that tell you about what it's made up of?
Just one proton.
And?
Electron.
One electron. So on the periodic table, all those elements are neutral. Hydrogen being number one has one proton and one electron. Those charges balance each other out. The proton in the core is positive. The electron flying around the outside is negative. So as an example, helium, which is number two, two protons, positive in the middle, two electrons flying around the outside, neutral. Let's take the hydrogen. NAD+ steals a hydrogen from glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate and becomes NADH+.
Right.
But here's the thing. It doesn't want that plus. So what it does is it steals another hydrogen from glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, so pulls it off, but takes the electron from that hydrogen, keeps it, and throws the rest away.
The proton away.
The proton away into the solution.
Okay.
Now, a proton is simply H+. A proton is a hydrogen ion.
Mm-hmm.
So in this process, NAD+ steals two hydrogen, one full hydrogen with the positive proton, negative electron, and just the electron from the second hydrogen, and then tosses the other hydrogen into the solution, so the cytoplasm, which has a positive charge with it, making the cytoplasm a little bit acidic because hydrogen ions, H+, is what makes a solution acidic.
Okay.
So this process makes the solution slightly acidic. So what is the equation here? NAD plus turns into NADH plus hydrogen ion, a free hydrogen
ion. Right, and so that will be the NADH will be used a bit later on when we get to the ETC.
Yes, so what the NADH ultimately has is one hydrogen that has two electrons.
Okay.
Right? So now we've got those parts that we want for later. Because glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate, we've got two of them, we actually produced two NADH molecules. We need to keep that in mind, right? Yep. So we need to keep that in mind.
Okay.
Now, the thing is that going from glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate into the next molecule, which is extremely important. What is the next molecule? Glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate turns into?
1,3-bisphosphoglycerate.
Okay. 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate. It needs to add another phosphate. So an inorganic phosphate comes in from the cytoplasm and just binds into it. So now you've got a phosphate on the first carbon and the third carbon.
But we lose one, no? Right? So this is a gaining step rather than a losing step. So we actually pull a phosphate off it to make it into 3-phosphoglycerate.
Well, that's the next step.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we've gone from glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate. We've added a phosphate to give us glyceraldehyde-1,3-bisphosphate. We've also stolen two hydrogens and two electrons, right? One of those hydrogens in the solution, but one of those hydrogens bound to NADH. And because there's two molecules of them, we've done this twice over.
Okay.
So now we've got the glyceraldehyde-1,3-bisphosphate.
Yep.
Now, the enzyme we used here, I said, was glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate dehydrogenase. So when you hear the dehydrogenase, think the NAD plus process. So to go from this step to the next, we have to, like you said, take that phosphate away so that we've then left with 3-phosphoglycerate. So simply, the 3-carbon molecule, we pop the phosphate off the first one and we've just got the phosphate left on the third one now.
Right, and so this is the first point where we make a bit of money back.
Yes, so if we're taking the phosphate off, something needs to pop it off, and that's ADP.
Yeah.
Takes it, adds the third and final phosphate to it, so it's ATP. So now we've just generated ATP energy.
And because we've got two of these, we've made two molecules of ATP.
So that's right.
So we're now back to even.
That's, yes, good point. Back to even.
So we haven't lost anything at this point.
Exactly.
In our investments.
And what we've made is 3-phosphoglycerate. A 3-carbon molecule with a phosphate on the third carbon, and we've got two of them, right? So to go from 3-phosphoglycerate, we actually go to 2-phosphoglycerate. We need to rearrange where the phosphate sits, and we use this not using an isomerase but using a mutase called phosphoglycerate mutase.
Okay.
And so now what we've got is the phosphate on the second carbon. Done. 2-phosphoglycerate. Next step is to add an oxygen between the phosphate and that second carbon. And we use an enzyme called enolase to do this. So now we've got...
So where's the oxygen? Water?
Yes. Comes from water.
Okay.
Yep. And so now you've got a 3-carbon molecule with an oxygen bound to the second carbon and a phosphate bound to that oxygen. And what we've just developed is something called phosphoenol pyruvate using the enzyme enolase.
Okay.
We're at the second last step.
Right.
Now we're going into the last step to go from phosphoenol pyruvate to pyruvate itself, the final step of glycolysis, arguably. Some say lactate's the final step, but we can discuss that later. To go from phosphoenol pyruvate to pyruvate, we use an enzyme called pyruvate kinase. What does that tell you? If there's a kinase?
Takes a phosphate off.
Takes a phosphate off. So we're removing that phosphate from the oxygen molecule, which is bound to the second carbon, and giving it to ADP to form more energy, ATP. And then we're left with pyruvate.
So we've made some money back.
Yep, made money back, and we've now made two molecules of a 3-carbon molecule called pyruvate.
Okay, so the take-home point at this stage is that from one molecule of glucose that has come into the cell, and it really doesn't matter what cell it is. I know we've focused on the liver cell, but any cell in the body will go through all this. One molecule of glucose, which is a six carbon molecule, all those steps that we just mentioned, and the end result is we've come out at the end with two molecules of ATP.
Four.
As a win?
Four.
Oh, four.
Yep. Come out with, we lost two, gained four, and gained two NADH.
Oh, okay. I thought we just had a two because the first ATP win.
Talking about net or gross?
Net.
Okay. Then yes.
Okay. Yeah. So we've got a two ATP net, plus we've also got a two NADH
net,
and we've got two molecules of pyruvate kinase.
Just pyruvate.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
Yeah.
Going back to pyruvate kinase, this is also a rate limiting step, and so some things can speed this up and slow this down. Okay, one of the things, well, actually two things that will slow it down again is ATP, but another interesting one is alanine, which is an amino acid. Do you want to quickly mention why this may be the case?
Right, so this is an important step, and it's a little bit confusing, but let's try and explain it. In muscle tissue, obviously glucose is used through glycolysis to make pyruvate produce ATP. The thing is that muscle uses a lot of proteins, and it doesn't just use the protein and keep using it for your whole life. When you use a protein, it tends to break down and have a byproduct, and that byproduct is ammonia. So muscle metabolism has ammonia as a byproduct. Ammonia can be toxic when it
excess.
So we need a way of getting rid of that ammonia, but you can't just throw it straight from the muscle into the bloodstream to get to the liver for the liver to deal with it, because that's what the liver does. It detoxifies these metabolic byproducts. Another reason why the liver deals with a lot of these biochemical processes. So muscle breaks down to the amino acids. The amino acids break down to the ammonia. Now here's the thing. Ammonia is bound up by an intermediate product called glutamate. Now, if you're producing pyruvate from glycolysis, pyruvate and glutamate can come together and swap things with each other. The glutamate forms alpha-ketoglutarate, which can jump into the Krebs cycle, which will be something we'll talk about in a second. That's great. We can utilize that to make ATP. And the pyruvate turns into alanine. Alanine can jump into the bloodstream.
That's safe.
Very easy, and jump into the liver. Here in the liver, the alanine will turn back into pyruvate, but we'll have to steal some alpha-ketoglutarate from the Krebs cycle to turn that into glutamate. Now remember, the glutamate's holding on to this ammonia.
Okay.
But the thing is that the liver can deal with ammonia now. So the glutamate hands the ammonia to the liver and undergoes the urea cycle to produce urea.
Which is a safer intermediate to get rid of through the kidneys.
Exactly. Throws it back into the bloodstream, kidneys filter it, you pee it out.
Mm.
So at the end of the day, what are we saying?
So basically alanine here would be suggestive that the muscles are secreting excessive amounts of alanine, which would be possibly that the muscles are in a fasting state. So they're trying to make their own energy through amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't get toxic buildup of nitrogen or, as you said, ammonia. They try to get rid of an amino acid being.
I'd say just a post-absorptive state. You could say, only because fasting has such a charged term now.
Okay, right.
People think, you know.
A non-fed state.
Yeah.
Okay. And that, so this alanine comes back into the liver, and therefore to prevent backlogging, it slows down pyruvate kinase to stop, you know, too much being built up.
Yeah, because if you think about it, if the liver is trying to make pyruvate through glycolysis, yet a whole bunch of alanine's jumping in that will also make pyruvate, there's a competition. And so the alanine is going to be a negative regulator of glycolysis, and glycolysis will likely be a negative regulator of alanine.
Yep.
So, you know, that makes total sense, because you need a homeostatic regulation of pyruvate production. But regardless, now we have pyruvate.
Yes.
Is this where we're at?
Yes.
All right. So we're still in the cytosol. We're not in the mitochondria yet, right?
And so for some cells, this is the end. Like we spoke about, red blood cells doesn't go beyond this, because they've got no mitochondria. So that's the end point for them. They've made their ATP, and that's enough for their function.
Yes. And in another podcast, we're going to talk about pyruvate going down another pathway to produce something called lactate. And how lactate can be utilized in anaerobic states, so no oxygen, but also in you know, normal metabolic states as well. But that's going to be another podcast because this is not the pathway we're going down. We're continuing through cellular respiration. We ultimately want to get to the mitochondria. But we need to take pyruvate and we need to turn it into something called acetyl-CoA so okay. it can jump into the mitochondria.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Right. And so this is an intermediate step for it to be able to have the ability to transport to the inner depths of the mitochondria.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, that's good.
Because the mitochondria has two membranes, right?
It does.
And so it needs to get across both to do its Krebs?
Thing. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So what happens is pyruvate, remember two molecules, need to turn into acetyl-CoA. So I'm going to stop saying two molecules now. All you know, you just know that we've got...
Pyruvate.
Yeah, pyruvate. All right, so pyruvate needs to turn into acetyl-CoA through an enzyme called pyruvate...
Two steps though, right?
Well, there's actually a lot of components here.
Okay.
But it's pyruvate dehydrogenase complex because there's a lot of things being involved here. But ultimately what we want to do is we need... Pyruvate's a three-carbon molecule.
Yep.
We need to turn it into a two-carbon molecule.
Okay.
So we need to get rid of a carbon. That's the first thing. We need to add a CoA to it, which is just a little side group that we need to add. And we need to pull off some hydrogen and electrons. So a lot of mm-hmm. things need to happen. So here's where we start to bring in some more B vitamins and derivatives of B vitamins. So we bring in this process of turning pyruvate to acetyl-CoA, we need vitamin B1.
Thionine.
Vitamin B3.
Niacin.
And vitamin B5. Pantothenic acid.
Okay.
All right. So let's think about it like this. Vitamin B1, its derivative here is thiamine pyrophosphate, TPP. It helps us play around with the carbons. That's how you think about TPP. Pantothenic acid also helps in this process as well. And vitamin B5, that is B5. Vitamin B3 is the NAD+. So first step, we need to pull off the carbon. We use B1 and B5, so thiamine pyrophosphate and pantothenic acid. We pluck the carbon off, snap it together with some oxygen. It forms carbon dioxide. We breathe that out.
Okay.
Done. There's the carbon. Buggers off, right? This is a decarboxylase process. That's when you take a carbon off, decarboxylase. So we've done that. Now B3 comes along in the form of nicotinamide adenine-dinucleotide, NAD+, pulls off two hydrogen. One it keeps with an extra electron, like I said before, and the other it tosses off as a hydrogen ion into the solution.
So that's more pH change.
That's right. Also, in doing this, we've stolen hydrogens and electrons for later, so keep that in mind.
Yeah,
and
that's a good point.
And because we've got two pyruvate, we're doing this twice over. So we've just made two NADH.
Yep.
The other thing is we need to add a CoA to it, and this is also through the help of pantothenic acid, right?
Snaps B5.
Snaps that CoA to the side. So now we've got a two-carbon molecule with a CoA attached to it, and we've produced two NADH.
Brilliant.
Through the enzyme pyruvate dehydrogenase complex. Using three B vitamins.
So this is why these B vitamins are known as carbohydrate kind of vitamins, right, for energy?
Yeah, the B vitamins are pretty much every B vitamin is involved in some biochemical pathway associated with the Krebs cycle.
Yeah, okay.
Super important. And there's just an example of three. So now we've got two acetyl-CoA molecules. This is a molecule that can now jump into the mitochondria. And now we enter...
So at this point, this is still happening in the cytoplasm?
Yes, and now the acetyl-CoA jumps into the mitochondria.
Okay. Right. So. Yeah, okay.
Let's talk about what happens now. We now enter a cycle that has three different names. The Krebs cycle, the tricarboxylic acid cycle...
Or
the citric acid cycle. We're going to say Krebs. I know we should be moving away from using, what's it called?
Pseudonyms.
But everyone knows.
Things named after people.
Yeah. But look, let's keep calling it Krebs for the time being because everyone really knows it as the Krebs cycle. But if you want to say tricarboxylic acid cycle or citric acid cycle, go for it. So what we need to talk about is that the acetyl-CoA in this cycle binds to something called oxaloacetate, which is actually a four-carbon molecule.
Okay.
So the two-carbon acetyl-CoA binds to the four-carbon oxaloacetate to form a six-carbon.
Yep.
Yeah, a bit slow on that one, which is called citrate. The enzyme that we use is citrate synthase.
Can we quickly just mention here, I know we're going to do a separate podcast on it, but how... the oxaloacetate's going to play an important role in what happens to acetyl-CoA. And so, at least in the liver, if we are deficient in oxaloacetate, then we may start building up acetyl-CoA and we need to, because we can't drive this citric acid cycle or the Krebs cycle anymore because we're deficient in oxaloacetate, then the liver has to repackage the acetyl-CoA into other intermediates, which is generally referred to the ketone bodies. I know we'll come back to that, but yeah. Is that okay just to mention?
Well, I guess I already not have. Really, because you can't just say deficient in oxaloacetate. We're saying why we're deficient in oxaloacetate.
Just, okay. So in the metabolic state that the liver would be in, it would be trying to, let's say it's a fasting state or a non-fed state. It would be using oxaloacetate to make new glucose, so gluconeogenesis. And so because it's, busy doing that, it doesn't have enough oxaloacetate in the hepatocyte cell to keep driving.
To bind with acetyl-CoA.
Yeah.
To keep driving this Krebs cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So at least the point here is acetyl-CoA is starting to build up, and the way that the liver deals with excessive acetyl-CoA, presumably in the mitochondria, is to repackage it into ketone bodies.
Yeah. But that's going to be the focus of another...
The side point I was just going to add here is there could be other states that would also increase acetyl-CoA amount. So not the production of it, but just the number of acetyl-CoA, and that could be just through lots of fatty acid entering it, or even alcohol would go down this pathway as well, which could then lead to the liver doing different things with acetyl-CoA.
Yep. Now forget all that. Because that will be the focus of another. It's important to mention, but forget that because we're just talking about glucose metabolism and how glucose is ultimately moving down this pathway. So now we've got acetyl-CoA bound to oxaloacetate called citrate, six-carbon molecule because oxaloacetate is four, acetyl-CoA is two, and the enzyme we use is citrate synthase. So now with the citrate, it needs to turn into something called isocitrate. And isocitrate basically is just a... you know, it's a rearrangement of citrate. So it uses an aconitase to do so. So the aconitase just rearranges citrate to isocitrate. Done. Still a six-carbon molecule. From isocitrate to the next step, which is alpha-ketoglutarate, this is important. We need to turn it from a six-carbon molecule to a five-carbon molecule. And we do it by removing carbon dioxide again. And so if we do that, it's a dehydrogenase step. And remember, dehydrogenase NADH, it's a decarboxylation step, but the enzyme is a dehydrogenase because we're also stealing more hydrogen with electrons.
Which is going to be important for those electron carrier things.
Yep. So isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate, we pop off a carbon, so it goes from a six-carbon molecule to a five in the form of carbon dioxide, and we take NAD+, steal two hydrogen with an an extra electron, toss one of those hydrogens in the solution as a hydrogen ion, and now we're left with NADH. And now the molecule we're left with is alpha-ketoglutarate, a 5-carbon molecule.
Awesome.
Alpha-ketoglutarate.
Can I just add one point here?
Yeah.
Well, it's actually an overview point. Can I still say it?
Go for it.
Just as a Krebs cycle, it's an 8-step process or cycle, has to go through 8 things. But half of them are dehydrogenase steps, which means that 50% of this whole thing is creating these things we're just talking about now, which is electron carriers.
Good point. Yeah, the whole purpose, again, is to pluck hydrogens and electrons from these molecules. And the Krebs cycle is a really efficient cycle to do this. So basically, we've just done the first step of pulling off these hydrogens and electrons from isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate. The next step is very similar to the one we just went through, where we go from a 5-carbon now to a 4-carbon. So we pull off another carbon dioxide.
Yep.
Pull off another carbon dioxide and we take more hydrogens with electrons through NAD+, again, producing more NADH. But this time we add a CoA to it. So because we're adding a CoA, because we're pulling carbon dioxides off, and because we're using NAD+, again, we're using vitamin B1, B3, B5 in this process, right? So we're using thiamine pyrophosphate, pantothenic acid, and niacin. So now what we've got is something going from alpha-ketoglutarate to succinyl-CoA.
Okay.
And the enzyme we used was alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase because, again, went from NAD+ to NADH2. So succinyl-CoA, because it's got the CoA to it, we need to go from succinyl-CoA into something called succinate. And we need to do this by doing a couple of important things. One, we need to pop off the CoA, again, strangely enough. So we pop the CoA off. We also need to give it a remove a phosphate from it. And so, interestingly, we remove the phosphate by giving it to ultimately ADP to form ATP, but we use it through an intermediate product, which is GDP.
Yeah.
So pop a phosphate off, give it from GDP to form GTP, which then pops it off to give it to ADP to give it to
okay. ATP. So it's like intermediate.
Exactly.
Middleman.
Exactly.
Middle right. Person.
Perfect. And that's using the enzyme succinyl-CoA synthetase. So we go from succinyl-CoA to succinate, 4-carbon with a CoA to just a 4-carbon with no CoA. And we've produced ATP. That's important.
And is there cofactors important here, like we saw in the pyruvate dehydrogenase? Like, is there important vitamins at this point, or was the whole Krebs cycle pretty?
The whole Krebs cycle obviously utilizes it, but yes, I'd popping off the CoA. I'm not sure what enzyme would be utilized, but the reason why the phosphate comes off here without the use of a coenzyme is when the CoA pops off because of succinyl-CoA synthetase. So this enzyme pops the CoA off. Energy is released by popping off the CoA. And that energy is the phosphate, okay, which can be stolen by GDP.
Okay.
Usually another enzyme would come in like a kinase, right, to help play around with the phosphate. But there's no kinase here. And the reason why is because GDP could steal it by piggybacking on the energy that was released when the CoA popped off.
Okay.
All right, so now we've got succinate, 4-carbon molecule. The succinate goes to fumarate, and here we actually don't use NAD+ to steal hydrogens and electrons. We use FAD. And FAD, see there's no plus there?
Flavonine or something?
Yeah, flavonide adenine dinucleotide.
So this is going to be B2?
Yes, B2. This is, yeah, vitamin B2. Perfect. So now we've used B1, B2, B3, B5. FAD does the same as NAD+, right?
Just carries the hydrogen, shoots a hydrogen off and carries an electron.
Well, not really. So what it does is, because remember NAD+ needed to steal a full hydrogen, a second hydrogen, which it buggered off but stole the electron from it.
Yep.
Here we don't need to steal that additional electron. So FAD just steals 2 hydrogens, both of them with their electrons.
Oh, okay.
Right? And so that's why it goes from FAD to FADH2.
Two.
And again, because there's two molecules of all these things, we've just made two molecules of FADH2.
Okay.
Again, this uses the enzyme succinate dehydrogenase. We go from fumarate to malate now, using the enzyme fumarase and by adding some water to it.
Or fumarate hydrase.
Yeah, you could say fumarase, fumarate hydrase, doesn't matter.
It utilizes, so it uses water here.
Yep. And then from malate, we go to oxaloacetate, which we said we utilize to fuse with acetyl-CoA. So
this brings us back to the start of the cycle.
Yes. And to go from malate to oxaloacetate, we use a dehydrogenase, malate dehydrogenase, and we use the NAD plus again to create two molecules of NADH plus hydrogen. So at the end of this whole process, right, we've created four carbon dioxide molecules.
Okay.
Six NADH molecules.
Is that for two pyruvates?
Yes.
For each acetylcholine, which we made a bit earlier from pyruvate, we make three NADH and one FADH2.
Yep.
And one GDP.
Or ATP.
And we two molecules of CO2.
That's right.
And we use that one bit of water. One molecule of water.
But what you could say, because effectively from one molecule of glucose...
Yeah, you double it.
You double it. So from one molecule of glucose, you've produced four carbon dioxide, six NADH, two FADH2, and two ATP molecules. So...
And this is in the inner... what do you call it? Not the cytoplasm of the mitochondria, but the inner part.
The equivalent of that. So what we've basically done is...
And would you say because the mitochondria is proposed that it's come from an early bacteria, that bacteria would be doing this themselves for energy?
Yeah.
So within their cytoplasm, and then they would be moving stuff across their membrane, which we'll discuss in a second.
Yeah, so the mitochondria is synonymous in a way with current bacteria. So... what we're about to talk about with the electron transport chain embedded in the membrane, bacteria just have that embedded in their normal membranes.
Right.
Right. They don't have the mitochondria because they are the mitochondria.
That's right.
All right. So just to highlight, because this is extremely important, what we've now produced that we're going to utilize to make the new fantastic thing, right, which is going to be ATP in this process, right?
Yeah. So
stripping the car, using that analogy, right? From glycolysis, we've produced two NADH. From the transformation of pyruvate to acetyl-CoA, we've produced two more NADH. And through the Krebs cycle, we've produced six NADH and two FADH2. So ultimately, we've produced...
And a lot of hydrogen, which will become important in a second as well.
Well, that's part of this, right? So we've produced 10 NADH2... Oh, sorry, 10 NADH and 2 FADH2.
Okay.
Which, like you just said, the importance of these molecules is they're holding on to a whole bunch of hydrogen ions and a whole bunch of electrons, which we're going to be pulling off them now.
Yes.
And this is now where we get to the inner membrane of the mitochondria, and embedded in the inner membrane, because like you said, there's two membranes, are a whole bunch of proteins.
Okay, and lipids.
And lipids.
Yeah.
Do you want to go through them? Do you want to just name them, or do you want to just do it sequentially?
No, let's name them as an overview, and then we'll...
All right. Do you want to do that?
Well, okay, sure. So the first in the line is complex one. Do you want to tell you any more than that?
Not really.
Okay. Complex one, which is some of these molecules span the whole membrane, so they're an integral protein, I guess you'd say. So they go across the whole length of the membrane.
As in both inner and outer?
Well, they have the ability to span the cytoplasm of the mitochondria to the space between...
Or to the intermembrane space.
That's it, intermembrane space.
So they're an integral inner membrane protein is what you're saying. Yes.
And that's important because they're going to be used for transporting hydrogen ions or protons.
Yeah.
Which is going to be the vacuum cleaner analogy that we're going to use.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So complex.
So you see complex one.
Complex one. Now, complex two, is that also called coenzyme Q, or is coenzyme Q just a part of it?
Coenzyme Q is just intimately related with complex two, but okay. It is not complex two.
Okay. Complex three is the next one along.
Yep.
That's also one that spans the length of the membrane.
Yep.
Then we go to cytochrome C.
Yep.
And which one's the fat out of these ones? So most of these are proteins, but one is it cytochrome C that's a fat or the lipid?
Not sure.
Okay.
Not sure.
I'll find out in a second. And then complex four, which is the last of them that will be carrying the electrons, which is important, again, to drive the concentration gradient of hydrogen.
Yep.
And then the last step will be the ATP synthase, which is kind of like the turbine that will be using the gradient of hydrogen to essentially make the ATP.
Yeah, to make all that energy.
Yeah.
All right, do you want me to go through it?
Yes.
Okay, so what's now happened is we've got all those NADH and FADH2 holding onto the hydrogen, holding onto the electrons. What happens is the NADH, first of all, will approach complex one, the very first integral protein here in what's called the electron transport chain. It's giving you an indication what's happening. It's transporting electrons along a chain of proteins. So NADH hands off. It goes in the opposite direction to what it did originally. So NADH turns to NADH. NADH turns into NAD plus, handing off
an electron,
the hydrogens and the electron. Now, it gives the electron to complex one. And when you give an electron to this protein, it excites it. And you excite it so much that it generates this force that can take the hydrogen ion, the H plus, and pump it across into the intermembrane space, the space between the inner membrane and the outer membrane.
So that's my first vacuum cleaner.
That's the first vacuum cleaner. So what we've done effectively is taken the hydrogens and the electrons from NADH, excited the complex one with the electron, which has allowed for us to pump the hydrogen ion into the intermembrane space.
And I think this complex one is a derivative of, again, B2. So it's a riboflavin complex.
It is, yes.
And it's got an iron and a sulfur incorporated within it.
That's exactly right. Yep. Yep.
So then, so now we can move it on. So the electron...
Well, the electron's stuck.
Okay.
It needs to be taken away, and it gets taken away by coenzyme Q10, which is sort of sitting next door to it. And it takes that electron and it passes it on. Now, before we... Let's just say coenzyme Q10's holding onto this electron. Let's just keep it there for the time being.
And this is it's a small enzyme that's in the middle of the membrane, so it's not spanning it.
It's not spanning the whole distance.
It's kind of sitting in front of or on top of complex two.
Now, or near it at least.
Yeah.
Now, complex two, it doesn't take NADH, it takes FADH2. And it does the same thing, strips it of the hydrogens and the electrons. But here's the thing. It gets excited by the electrons, but it doesn't have a vacuum cleaner to suck the hydrogens across into the intermembrane space. So the hydrogen ions are sort of stuck in the cytoplasm of the mitochondria, or whatever the term is that we use, right? The inner space of the mitochondria. But so the second complex is still excited by the electron, which it hands off to coenzyme Q10. So now what we've got is complex one and complex two have both handed coenzyme Q10 the electrons. It can then hand it off to complex three. And
can I just make one point here?
Go for it.
This particular complex two is also the same complex that's in one of the steps of Krebs. So this is succinate dehydrogenase as well. So this complex two also plays a role in the Krebs cycle, and that would be kind of intimate in terms of the speed of both the Krebs cycle but also the electron transport chain, because they have a shared enzyme.
And it makes sense, because the succinate dehydrogenase was used at the step to go from succinate to fumarate, which is where we turned FAD to FADH2.
Yep.
We're just using it in the opposite direction now to go from FADH2 to FAD. So quick recap, NADH has handed off hydrogens and electrons to complex one. FADH2 has handed off hydrogens and electrons to complex two. Complex one gets excited by the electron, pumps hydrogens across into the intermembrane space. Complex two gets excited by the electron, doesn't have the vacuum cleaner to do that same thing. But both hand the electrons off to an intermediate, which is coenzyme Q10.
Which is the lipid. This is the only lipid of this complex. Yep.
Great. Now, coenzyme Q10 will hand the electron off. So we're playing hot potato with electrons now. Takes the electron, hands it off to complex 3, which has an iron ion, Fe3+, which takes the electrons and basically gets excited and pumps more hydrogen ions across into the intermembrane space.
Second vacuum cleaner.
So only complex 1, complex 3 at the moment are vacuum cleaners, not complex 2.
And when we say vacuum cleaners, what's been sucked up is essentially the hydrogen ions from the inner part of the mitochondria to the intermembrane
space. Between the inner and outer membrane. Yeah. If you have an image in front of you, it makes it a lot easier. The electron then gets transferred across to cytochrome C.
And is this where it's utilizing iron, the change in electrons in the iron? So what is it, Fe3+ to Fe2+?
2+, yeah. So there's iron ions in complex 3, cytochrome C, and complex 4. So they all use the iron to transfer the electrons. So basically complex 3 throws the electrons across to cytochrome C, which throws the electron across to complex 4, which gets excited and pumps more hydrogen ions across.
I've got complex 4 as copper, not iron. They may have both.
Okay, maybe it does. I'm not sure. But all I know is, well, not all I know, but one thing I know is complex 1, 3 and 4, they get excited by the electrons to pump hydrogens across into the intermembrane space.
Yep.
Now, very finally, complex 4 has the electrons. What does it do with it? It gives it to molecular oxygen, which splits the oxygen apart. Remember, oxygen is O2, splits it apart so it's just O, but a negatively charged O, which then binds with some of the spare hydrogen ions to form water.
Right.
Makes sense.
Yep.
Negative oxygen, positive hydrogen, enough come together to form H2O. They all have partial charges with them, so we produce water. So this is why oxygen is the terminal electron acceptor. That's what it's termed in this process. It's the last place that the electrons go is water.
And hence why you need oxygen for cellular respiration.
Exactly.
So if you were hypoxic here, this process would be in problem.
Well, think about it. If you didn't have the oxygen to finally take those electrons to turn to water, which we know that we can excrete very easily or utilize, right? The electrons are stuck in complex 4 and then they'll back up into complex 3 and back up into cytochrome C and back up into complex 2 and back up into coenzyme Q10 and then back up into complex 1, which means it backs up into Krebs cycle, which means it back and so forth. So this is the reason why you, like you said, you need oxygen in this process. And this is actually beautiful because you can say that all this whole process of stealing electrons and hydrogens ends up making water, which is nice. So through metabolism, you make water. But the whole purpose of it is to simply pump hydrogen ions into the membrane that sits between the inner and outer membrane of the mitochondria, the space.
So now that space becomes highly concentrated with hydrogen ions.
I think like 10 to the negative 10 or something, hydrogen ion concentration. It's twice as concentrated as it would normally be now with all these hydrogen ions in the intermembrane space.
And with the whole process that we've gone through today, glycolysis, Krebs, and now here, is the majority of water made at this point?
Yeah.
Okay. So going back to biochemistry, I think I did an assignment. I can't remember the details of it.
So it didn't do very well?
I think it went okay. But the question was basically asking from if you had this type of meal and they gave it in grams or something like that, how many water molecules would you create? Right. And you had to go through all the processes of fat, proteins, and glucose, and then add up the water.
That's cool.
But some animals, I'm thinking camels for some reason.
I knew you were going to say camels. I knew it.
Get enough water molecules from cellular respiration to keep it going.
Right.
Alive, if they're not drinking.
So
and the camel.
Very efficient cellular respiration process.
I think that they're getting it from fat because the humps are just fat. And so they're just breaking down fat, so beta oxidation into acetyl-CoA and then driving that presumably the same thing, but they can somehow access that cellular water for their survival.
Look, it makes sense. Like, we need water for survival, and it's just hydrogen and oxygen. All of our primary nutrient sources, proteins, fats, carbs, are all made up of carbons, oxygens, and hydrogens. And obviously the proteins have nitrogen added to it. But they all have oxygens and hydrogens that you can steal from, right?
Yeah.
You can steal the hydrogen and oxygen to make this water. And this is one process in which you can do that. So now we've got this high concentration of hydrogen ions, H+, in the intermembrane space. It needs to go down its concentration gradient by moving through this very complex protein, or I should say complex of proteins, called ATP synthase. Now, let's just explain it in a way that makes sense, I think. The hydrogen ions...
It's like a water wheel.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, like a windmill, in a sense, where instead of the wind pushing the turbine, you've got hydrogens moving down...
The gradient.
Its gradient, telling this protein to spin, and the spinning of this protein physically forces ADP and phosphate together to form ATP.
Right.
And that's the ATP synthase. All of these steps...
What we've done.
From glycolysis...
Is just for this.
Through the Krebs is simply for this one protein complex to pump hydrogens down its concentration gradient, to spin some proteins, to physically force ADP and phosphate together to form ATP. And you form around about 32 to 36 ATP molecules at the end of all this process.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is amazing. And that's it.
A couple of side points here.
Nope.
Which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
So with the electron transport chain, we've got these complexes that we've spoke about, that some is just purely about transporting the electrons amongst each other,
yeah,
which drives an electric current. But also there's some that is just pushing, well, I guess in conjunction to that, we're also just vacuum cleaning the hydrogen into that intermembrane space. But there has to be that kind of process occurring for it to drive the whole process. Now, there are some things that kind of, some drugs or some endogenous agents that,
sure,
that break this kind of connection between the two.
Particularly at the electron transport chain.
One of them is an uncoupling agent. So it kind of puts a protein on the membrane and it loses...
Of the cell or the mitochondria?
Of the mitochondria.
Yep.
And you lose all the hydrogen. It just pulls the hydrogen back in.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so that in the protein or the hormone that does this is called thermogen or thermogenin.
Right.
And so this can be seen in brown fat.
Okay.
And so we know...
Wait, we make this?
Yes. This is an endogenous agent.
Why?
Okay. So if you were to put this uncoupling agent into the membrane and you lose all the hydrogen gradient, what would it do is that you're still driving the electrons, but you're losing the gradient.
Right.
And so what that does is create heat.
Oh.
And so it's kind of like, I don't know, your car's engine's running.
Right, because
but it's not
it excites
driving
the proteins,
yeah,
but it can't release that energy through the proton force. It has to release it in the form of heat.
Correct. And
right,
so babies produce this in their brown fat.
Is this the thermogenic process of brown fat?
Yes.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Is this how it works?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And also hibernating animals.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that that's how it worked. That is super cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
There's also...
But that also means they don't produce as much energy.
Well, I guess they don't. At least in that tissue, they don't need to.
Right.
But the benefit of that is to regulate heat,
yeah,
for the animal whilst they're either sleeping or for the baby.
Oh, how cool.
I don't know. Also sleeping.
All right, next point.
Aspirin can also play around with this.
Where at?
The same kind of uncoupling agent.
Oh.
And this can lead to a metabolic acidosis.
Because it releases the hydrogen ions into the cytoplasm.
Right. And so that then is part of the reason for... I always thought metabolic acidosis from aspirin was due to because it is an acid.
Right.
But it's actually partly because of this process.
Okay.
And then because of the effect that this could then have if you're influencing, let's say, respiratory muscles and you're not getting the energy for respiratory muscles, then you can get a respiratory acidosis from it as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's agents that uncouple. Or,
what about like rat poison? Doesn't that come in at the mitochondrial?
Oh, rat poison is just warfarin, really. So I think you just bleed out.
But isn't there another process in which it can inhibit some of these complexes?
Yeah, so then you can get the ones that will inhibit, I think, the synthase.
Right.
Okay. Oh, no, sorry. Sorry. There are a couple of agents that inhibit the complexes. So cyanide inhibits complex 4.
Cyanide, that's right. Yeah.
So that will then stop the gradient or the electron movement.
You just don't produce any ATP.
Right. And so that will lead to the death of the individual because every cell will be impacted at cell respiration.
And you die pretty quick, right? Like this is the thing that people don't realize is that you'd go, well, ATP is really important for life, for just the general function of everything. So wouldn't we evolve in abundance? We don't. We've got like a few minutes of ATP available in our body that we will use up in, you know, obviously very quickly.
Yeah.
So it needs to be regenerated all the time. Hence why we need to eat all the time. Hence why we need fuel all the time.
Yeah.
We need this glucose. But yeah, that's amazing.
Barbiturates? Barbiturates. So that would be like pentobarbital.
Yep.
As an example. That would impact complex 1. Same outcome. This would be in a high dose. And these are like GABA agonist, I guess you'd say.
Okay.
But this would be in the toxic range of that that drug. And the other one, which is interesting because you asked me this the other day, statins.
Right, yes.
Remember you said something about…
Statins and muscle pain.
Muscle pain, yeah. So statins for some people, not everyone, will inhibit the coenzyme Q.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And so what that does will decrease the ATP, particularly in muscle.
Okay.
So it just… doesn't inhibit it completely, but maybe slows down that process.
Is that the proposed mechanism as to why people get muscle pain with statins?
So for some individuals, I guess it's impacting the electron transportation enough to decrease the ATP in muscle, which then leads to cramping and then pain.
Wow.
But it could be enough for some individuals that leads to muscle death, which is rhabdo.
Right.
Which then can lead to kidney problems because you've got…
Because I know that tendinopathies are very common in people who take statins.
Yeah.
And I don't think they know why. I mean, I haven't investigated it, but interesting.
Apparently that is the link there.
Oh, there you go. Mm. Any other processes? Are we done with cellular respiration?
Yeah, I think that's it.
Wow. Are we going to do some listener mail?
Oh, yes. I sent you a couple.
Okay.
And… I will read a few as well.
Okay. Which email did you send it to?
Dr. Mike.
All right.
Let me…
So, let's do some listener mail.
Okay. Have you got your one?
Nope. Oh, yes. Okay.
You start, then I'll go…
Hey guys, I'm really liking your videos. This is from Alex. Do you have any OSCE tips for paramedic students? Matt, do you have any OSCE tips?
We don't really teach paramedic students in the clinical space.
We don't.
We
Our friend Sandy does.
Yeah, Sandy's great, but that's not going to help you much at all.
Practice.
Yeah, sorry, I can't really help in that space.
Practice. Go to as many OSCE labs as you possibly can do. So
definitely,
do you want to tell people what OSCEs are? There might be people out there who have no idea what an OSCE is. OSCE.
Basically, my understanding, I don't know what it stands for, but it's just a clinical…
I don't know what it stands for either, to
examination assessment.
Yeah.
So practical assessment on doing
clinical work.
Clinical stuff, yeah.
I reckon practice. I know it's not super useful, but I think the more you physically do it, the more the muscle memory gets in. And when you know, literally practice makes perfect. And if you're immersed in the clinical environment, you get to practice doing that particular task, you'll do a better job when it comes to evaluating that OSCE. So practice. Now, I haven't pre-read any of these emails, so we haven't been able to prepare any specific answers, so I don't even know what it's saying. So we've got one here from Maywind Osman. Maywind, thank you for the email, first of all. The subject is, just want to say thank you. Well, thank you. But there is a message here. Can I please reach out and say thank you so much for your free content on YouTube? You're welcome. It has been unbelievably helpful. I'm turning 30 this year and spent 6 years of my life in prison. Whoa. And 2 years on strict parole condition with 1 year left to complete. Oh, amazing. However, I've enrolled in uni and your videos have been so useful. They're my primary resource. Way better than any uni lecturer. I've been able to learn and what they try and explain in 5 weeks in one video. Thank you kindly. Cheers, guys. Thank you so much. I mean, amazing. This is the first time I have heard anybody that has watched our videos. Obviously,
praise us.
to praise us, yes. But I'm so glad we can help. So thank you. Thank you, Maywind.
I've got an email from Susie Hook. Subject, I am so thankful, exclamation mark. Message, I have just become a casual academic teaching nursing students in 1, 2, and 3rd year. So having to very quickly reacquaint myself with pathophysiology and of many body systems as well in general anatomy. But you guys make sense. I truly listen once or twice, review my study notes, and voila, it makes sense and I can teach on. Thank you.
Oh, awesome. Do I have another one? That's a question.
I've got one more. Oh, Louise again from Canada.
Yeah.
Remember she said that I stuffed up that Santa Claus one?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So she's said, my students have requested a YouTube/podcast on the peritoneum versus the mesenteries versus the omenta.
You can do that.
So we could do a podcast on it? Or do you think it's too niche?
I don't know. I think you can definitely do a video on it. Yeah. I know that.
I actually have to do a video on that for embryology.
I've got another – well, there you go. You can do it. I've got another email from Amri. Amri says, hey, guys, I just started studying clinical nutrition at the age of 36. That's my age too, Amri. And honestly, you're probably the reason that I made it through the first semester. Well, thank you very much. I've come to realize that I want to master the basics of biochemistry and dive into the science to go beyond standard nutritional guidelines. If you guys had a course on cell biology and metabolism, I would be stoked. Thanks for making hard things fun. You're welcome, Amri. Really appreciate the email. We are trying to build some little online courses, breaking news, folks, for people to be able to access. Because it takes time and energy and it costs us money to make, we need to charge a very small amount. I don't know what that amount's going to be, but we'll have some mini online courses for people to be able to engage with, and I will endeavor to make sure that they include biochemistry. Things like this podcast.
Talking about making things, we've got an email from Jonathan, and he made some fan art of you, Michael.
Did he now?
Do you want to see it?
I do want to see it. Okay. Can you show it to me?
There.
All right. Oh, wow. Okay. Thank you.
I think you partly look like Batman.
Well, that's nice to say. I appreciate it. Is that from Jonathan?
That's Jonathan.
Thank you, Jonathan. Very much appreciated.
And the last one is Alan. Alan's asked quite a complicated question, which will take us a bit of time to research. But basically, he's just asking a question on the neurophysiology of massaging a muscle on stretch.
Oh, okay.
So it's quite a long question. I won't read it all out, but we'll have to do some investigation to see the benefit possibly of during a massage, stretching the muscle, how that could have a greater impact than a non-stretched muscle.
Well, off the top of my head, I know that a recent study came out to show that constant exaggerated stretch of the gastrocnemius, the calf, led to hypertrophy of the calf. So you can actually get muscle growth through stretching.
Really?
There's evidence for that. So
how would that work physiologically?
Well, I think when you think about muscle hypertrophy, particularly skeletal muscle, you can get it through metabolic stress, you can get it through damage, and you can get it through load and resistance. And so
wouldn't damage be the most common? Oh, when you say damage, do you mean micro tearing?
Yeah. But the thing is that historically, we didn't think that damage alone or metabolic stress alone were enough for hypertrophy. You needed them in conjunction with exposure to load. But this has demonstrated that you can get hypertrophy simply off the back of stretching. So I don't know if that's the case through massage. The thing was they did some – if you look at the paper, I don't know the title of the paper. It was extreme stretching of the gastroc, like longer than you would normally do and more extreme than you normally would do. So whether that has any practical implications, I don't know. But we'll get back to you, Alan. Matt, we done?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening to this episode. If you like us.
If you made it to the end.
If you did make it to this point, please.
And you didn't run out of that, and you didn't run out of the ATP.
Give us a 5-star rating. If it's not worth 5 stars, well, I'm sorry. You can follow us on social media at Dr. Mike Todorovic. You can send us an email if you go to drmattdrmike.com.au and email us from our website. Yeah. If you want to join our mailing list, which has updates of podcasts, YouTube videos, and just additional fun content and some other educational resources we produce, go to drmattdrmike.com.au and sign up to our newsletter. We'll be sending newsletters out hopefully monthly very soon. But apart from that, thank you, Matthew.
And we'll be back with more biochemistry
soon.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.